This is 89.3 FM KPDO, and this is Local Revolution. I'm Aaron Murphy, and on our program today, we're going to discuss the local movement. What does it mean to buy local? Why are local foods and clothing better when they're made closer to home? Is it worth paying extra to buy local goods, and are they always better quality, but also more expensive than goods from China? My guest today is Daniel Theobald, the founder of Twisted Fields Farm in San Gregorio. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Aaron.
You know, the coronavirus is currently at its peak here in Central California. How are you coping with the virus at home and at work right now?
Well, it's interesting that I think it has, clearly taken a great toll on society and the economy as a whole. I tend to be a silver linings kind of person and look for the benefits that it's also providing. And I think in many ways it has helped us to re-examine our connections to the people around us. It's allowed us to re-examine our connections to the earth and to our food in ways that perhaps were not as poignant prior to the crisis. It has been great for us to be in a position to be in such a beautiful landscape with plenty of social distancing by nature. And so we don't take that for granted. We're very grateful for the opportunity that we have to be in an agrarian society here in San Gregorio. And we know that not everybody has that opportunity. But, I think the silver linings aspect of all this will certainly leave us a number of lessons learned and hopefully we'll come out better for it.
Yeah, that does seem to be the case. I mean, a lot of farmers, I understand, in this area and all over the country, the world, I'm sure, are running out of food if they operate at the retail level, supplying food to local families and stuff. Have you been experiencing any of that because of the virus where you're just sort of cleaned out by the demand?
Yeah, we have an incredible demand, particularly for our eggs. And it has been challenging. Right at the beginning, we were donating a significant number of eggs to some charities. We've just got such incredible demand. We've sort of been rationing our eggs across a number of different customers. We have a range of customers, each who are begging us for more eggs than we can supply them. So, instead of sort of just going to the person willing to pay the highest price, we've decided to take an approach of, spreading them out more evenly across the customer base to try and make sure that to the extent possible, everybody has access to the fresh eggs that we provide.
That's great. That's really equitable of you to operate like that. I understand that basically every farm supply store in the country is running out of baby chickens because everybody now wants to grow, of course, their own farm fresh eggs. Have you experienced any problems with the supply chain for chickens?
Well, we're fortunate that we have the space here to do a lot of that ourselves. So we incubate a significant portion of our own chickens. We try and keep our genetic pool wide and varied. So we do bring in baby chicks from a number of outside sources periodically, just to keep our genetic pool diverse. We're big fans of genetic diversity. We don't try and create the one strain of chicken that produces the absolute perfect egg, and in the process introduce all kinds of other problems. We really believe that food security, biosecurity, these are all things that biodiversity is our ally. As you know, I think maybe most people don't understand this. Large industrial farming really operates on a monoculture type of approach. Yeah. They will find one strain of wheat or corn or chicken and really create these massive monocultures with a very, very narrow gene pool, because that gene, that particular DNA produces some favorable characteristics that help them with their bottom line. Mm-hmm. The problem there is that it creates a very fragile biome, or a very fragile genetic environment, where if something changes and that particular DNA no longer is appropriate or suitable or competes well, you can have massive problems.
Right. Well, that's amazing that you you raise your own chickens. That probably decouples you from the distribution chain that right now is breaking down. You must feel pretty self-reliant in that way.
That's really the goal for us, is to produce essentially everything we need here locally. Local production is best when it's truly local. I applaud anybody who is working hard to grow food locally and meet local demand. Unfortunately, many times it's more of a marketing gimmick than it is reality, because they are, essentially importing much of the supply side of that from elsewhere.
Sure.
So again, I think we're fortunate that we're in a position where we can have the possibility of growing almost everything we need here locally on the farm. And it's a challenge, but at the end of the day, that whole self-reliance thing is really powerful when you see how something like a little virus can disrupt supply chains across the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I can see how some farms may call their products local, which, you know, in one degree they are, but if you're buying grains in bulk organic chicken feed from Asia, then it really is a, you know, it puts into question really how local are you, I guess, doesn't it?
Yeah. All of these things are great. It's a spectrum, obviously.
Yeah.
And having the chickens here versus having, you know, shipping the eggs across the planet, that's probably a net positive. The more you can do locally, the better it is for the environment, the better it is for the consumer. You've probably covered this in the past, but there's a tremendous amount of credible research that shows that the nutritional content of food starts to degrade from the moment it's picked. Mm-hmm. And, you know, broccoli, I think, is an example that's particularly impressive in the vitamin content that's lost in the first 24 hours when it becomes disconnected from the ground.
Wow.
So the idea of actually growing food that's optimized for, you know, its genetic diversity and its taste, its flavor, its vitamin content. These are things that you can do if you're growing locally. If you are planning on shipping, then you really have to optimize your crops to ship.
Yeah.
This is why at the grocery store, we tend to find tomatoes that feel more like plastic than they do like food. They taste more like plastic than they do like food.
Sure.
And that's simply because good tomatoes don't keep well. Tomatoes with a good flavor, with a nice texture, that aren't mealy, that really have that robust taste, those don't enjoy traveling on trucks.
Yeah.
So by the time they get to the grocery store, they're done and nobody's going to buy them. So if you can really get the heirloom vegetables that are superior flavor, superior size, oftentimes superior nutritional value, and get it locally, it's a win-win-win.
Yeah, that's great. Do you grow tomatoes in addition to chickens? Actually, tell me about some of the things you grow there.
Yeah, so we are a research farm at the end of the day. Now, one of the things we realized early on is that we weren't going to be a particularly effective research farm if we weren't providing real goods and services to real people, because then the research becomes disconnected from reality.
Yeah,
our research goal is to understand and to help to solve the problem of how can local organic farmers operate profitably and produce a wide variety of crops for their constituents. We are operating in a community-supported agriculture model, which means that people sign up for a farm share. They're essentially buying rights to part of the farm's output for a season. And, you know, that comes with some risk because there's no guarantees that the farm will be successful in any particular season. But it comes with tremendous amount of reward as well. One, you're going to get incredibly healthy food that's not covered in pesticides and actually tastes great and is healthy for a lot lower cost than you would get it at, a place Whole Foods or Safeway or anything like that. You know, those are good stores, but they have a very different business model.
Sure.
And in addition to that, it also really helps people to understand where their food comes from and have an appreciation for the reality of farming and food and nutrition that, when you just go to the grocery store and pull things off a shelf, it's really kind of a travesty that there's a complete lack of understanding of our food supply and how that whole system works. So to get back to your original question, our thesis here is, can we use technology to effectively produce a wide range of crops, fruits, vegetables, eggs, in a way that's economically feasible? And on the technology side, we use a broad range of different approaches. On the one side, you know, the sort of fanciest side, we're building a number of agricultural robots.
Cool.
To help with some of the massive labor shortage problems that we're experiencing in the agriculture sector. But also just a lot of more practical, farm automation things. RFID tracking on the chickens. Now, our chickens are completely pasture raised. They are free to come and go as they please. They go out onto our 127 acres and live a wonderful life and scratch for bugs and seeds and grass and, you know, all
That's
the things
great.
That real chickens like to do. They're very happy. And we find that, happy chickens really lay the best eggs. And that makes a big difference. But, how do you manage that effectively? It's not as cost effective to raise chickens that aren't in cages. That's just the unfortunate reality. So part of our research is, how do you do this in a way that you can have it be economically feasible while being humane and producing a superior product?
That's great. Does the RFID tags, does any of that information yet, or is it in the works to basically provide that information to consumers about sort of the daily activities of the chicken or any other thing that consumers might like?
Oh, that's a really great question. I hadn't really thought about that up until now, but it's very possible that we could get to a point where we could essentially, on the carton of eggs, we could basically put which chickens laid those eggs in the future. We're not there yet.
Yeah, that'd be fun as a consumer. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's the mommy of your eggs.
Yeah.
One of the things that people really love about our eggs is that they're Easter eggs, in the sense that, we have brown and green and blue and orange and white and speckled. And, you open up our dozen eggs and it looks like somebody's dyed them. that's part of what comes along with the genetic diversity side of things, but it's also just a lot of fun. And the whole idea with the RFID tags is, when a chicken, is out in the field doing what they do, they feel an egg coming on, and they need to go in and lay their egg. They basically go in and they choose a nest to lay their egg in, and there will be an RFID antenna in each one of those nests. And as that chicken enters the nest, it will register which chicken entered the nest. And then as the eggs are collected, we know which chickens have laid those eggs. And so this does a number of things for us. It can help us to identify problem areas. If there are chickens that are not laying eggs, it could be that they have found a creative place to leave their eggs out in the fields. And obviously, we'd like to know that and be able to resolve that situation. You know, if there's a chicken that is sick or having other problems, it helps us to identify it and resolve it. Then it also can help us to identify those chickens that are laying the best eggs and give special attention to those when we are incubating the next generation of layers.
How great. That's super interesting. I'm excited to hear more about your research. That sounds really like it could offer a lot of benefit both for your operational efficiency, but also for consumers. So I would like it if you could explain to maybe listeners who don't know what an RFID is, because both of us have been talking about this and we both know what those are, but in a really simple terms, how would you describe the collar that they're wearing?
Yeah, it's actually on one of their legs. It's put on with a zip tie very loosely. They don't even seem to notice it at all. And it's just like a little keychain fob, little piece of plastic. It's got a small circuit board inside. It has no power source. And what happens is when it comes within range of an RFID antenna, it energizes that RFID tag, and then there's a wireless exchange of information. So for anyone who uses a key fob or a badge at work to, open a door, those type of things, those are generally RFID systems. So that little, you hold your card up to the door, it goes beep, the door opens. That's the exact same technology.
Well, I definitely see how, in a way, you're distinguishing yourself also from a consumer standpoint by having really maintaining quality. Like, I think, the argument when we bring it back to the local discussion is about not only the energy inputs and where did your, where did the grains come from to feed your chickens, but also, like, especially for people that are concerned about the quality of the life of the chicken, I think what you're doing really offers a distinction to maybe not only justify what may currently be a higher price, but simultaneously you're also possibly using technology that can actually lower the price for consumers. Can you talk about that a little bit?
You know, we recognize that if it's the best product in the world, but no one can afford it, that it's not really going to make a difference. And it's also important to us to have the high quality local food that is affordable to a wide range of, a wide range of consumers. This shouldn't be just for the, Palo Alto elite. Yeah. It should be something that local families can afford to eat healthy as well. I don't know if you've heard of the term food deserts, but in some of the research that we've done with the USDA, food deserts are a real issue. What a food desert is when there is an area that really only offers convenience store food to the local families who don't have cars or other forms of transportation to go to a more conventional grocery store. And so those families will end up growing up on Coca-Cola and potato chips.
Right.
There's no surprise that diabetes is one of the biggest killers in our country right now. So using technology to reduce costs of healthy food is what it's all about for us. And those costs generally come down to labor. There have been a lot of concerns, particularly in the media over the past few years, about technology taking jobs the whole human versus robots thing that is popular to talk about. The reality is that there is not a shortage. I mean, obviously with the coronavirus, everything's changing right now. But prior to this, we simply could not find workers. And this is a problem across the agriculture industry. There are just not enough workers to even harvest the food quite often. So you've got perfectly good food rotting in the field simply because they can't find workers to do it. Now, it's a twofold problem. One is that people don't want to do that work. It's not pleasant work. And two, the current economics of food have been driven by massive industrial conglomerates with large monocultures where, you know, they can figure out how to get the price of that egg down to the absolute rock bottom bare minimum. And so it's a little bit of a catch-22 for the consumer, because you want to stretch your dollar as far as you can. You know, that's what anybody who's trying to raise a family does. But on the flip side, you know, longer term, we're creating a problem for ourselves, and that we can't get healthy food for a decent price.
Well, that's where I think the virus is really maybe shaking up that whole catch-22 a little bit, don't you think? Quite possibly. I mean, we won't know until, you know, the economy starts to recover.
Yeah, is it going to stick or not?
Yeah, that has definitely been the right, because I've even seen memes on you know, Facebook. People are like, oh, this crisis came around and now I'm cooking, you know, homemade dishes for my family that I've never seen more. And my kids are at home and playing outside. And, you know, I'm spending time.
That's what I call the silver linings. Silver linings. Yeah. Well, I think it's really interesting, you know, to take a little bit of a diversion here for a second.
Sure.
For the history of the human race, children and parents have spent their days together. And you've gone out and you've grown or picked or hunted your own food. And we have become not only disconnected from our food, but we've become disconnected from our families. Mm. And for most of us in the human race right now, that's just the way it's always been as far as we're concerned. But we don't realize that this idea of parents and children being apart is brand new, and we have not yet fully even comprehended the effects, good or bad, probably mostly bad, that are going to result from that over time. So it's really interesting to hear people reconnect with their families and start to understand what we've been missing out on, because the Industrial Revolution said parents should go to factories and kids should go to school.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard that, you know, statistically they're saying, I think I've read that like in the 1930s or maybe the 40s, that over like 30% of the American population was participating in farming in some degree or another. And now I think it's less than 3% of Americans participate in growing food.
Right. Yeah, the statistic as I understood it was 100 years ago, it was actually 70%. 70 of people, you know, had a job in the agriculture industry. And today it's less than 3%. I think it's less than 2% now, which is a good thing in that it has allowed us to pursue a broader range of activities, you know, science, exploring the universe, arts, education, you know, those are all good things, but there is a cost. Mm-hmm. And I think we're just really starting to understand the long-term implications of those costs. For example, in the United States, healthcare, you know, these are not exact numbers, but it's something like healthcare accounts for 1/3 of the gross domestic product, meaning 1/3 of every dollar, or 1 out of every $3 spent in the United States is spent on something healthcare or healthcare related. Now that's crazy. It's absolutely crazy that we spend more money on healthcare than we do on, you know, on food. I had a friend who, you know, was a little bit quirky, but he would always say to me, he said, "Hey, I'd rather pay the grocer than the doctor."
Yeah.
And, you know, at the time I kind of chuckled a little bit at that, but, there's a lot of wisdom in that.
You know, I wanted to actually get back to your farm, and I guess I am interested in the use of technology. You talked a little bit about, you know, your use of the research robot and, the technology with the chickens and everything. And I guess I did want to conquer that question. Like, what do you say to someone who, and I'm sure there's, and your farm, it probably, I'm curious to know what you'll say, that, you know, you're using a robot that could very well be taking a job away from someone. What's your typical answer to that situation?
Yeah. Yeah, let me talk about that a little bit, and then afterwards, I'd be happy to just sort of go through a list of all the different technology projects we've got going on, because I think you'd find that interesting.
Great.
But yeah, the technology versus human labor question is something that has been at the forefront of human thought really ever since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. But the actual case study, I guess I would say, goes all the way back to prehistoric times. Homo sapiens sapiens versus Neanderthals. Why did Neanderthals die out while Homo sapiens eventually dominated and thrived? There was about a 1,000-year period where Homo sapiens sapiens and Neanderthals coexisted on the European continent. But you saw this gradual shift of Homo sapiens winning out. And, this is all speculative. So, nobody shoot me if there's more recent research. But the original theory was that there was a lot of wars going on and, Homo sapiens were killing Neanderthals, but it appears that that was probably not the dominant factor. It was that the Homo sapiens sapiens were able to create technology that helped them to be more resilient. Mm-hmm. What do I mean by that? For example, Homo sapiens sapiens invented the sewing needle and were able to start sewing clothing. Clothing allowed them to be more resilient to weather changes and a wider variety of climates. And it's also interesting to understand that these technology advances almost always benefit the weakest in society disproportionately, because the strong, the strong people, well, they didn't need clothes. They were fine. It was the weaker and the sick that really benefited from, having clothing and shelter and those type of things. Mm. Another Homo sapien advantage was they had better communication. And when you are able to communicate more effectively, you're better able to trade. You're better able to understand the needs of those in society. Now, I think the most skeptical among us would generally say, well, yes, but technology generally, benefits the rich and the poor just kind of get screwed. That can happen, but these are things that you have to look at on a macroscopic level over, centuries a lot of times. And technology always ends up benefiting society as a whole as it becomes accessible, affordable. Just think about the internet. The internet is a great example. Are there bad things about the internet? Yeah, I'd say there's lots of bad things about the internet. But when you think about the positive impacts it has had to us in terms of education, in terms of freedom around the world, in terms of helping people get access to economic resources that they need, microloans and that kind of thing, the benefits are far-reaching. So the whole technology versus jobs thing is a really complex subject. So this tension really started in the loom worker era, right? There were the Luddites. That's right. You know this. They worked the looms, and that was really slow work, because every time those threads would cross, then you'd have to have a human being run this big needle all the way across it and then switch the threads over again. Well, one day somebody came along and said, hey, I think I can build a machine that can do that part. Well, this caused a significant upheaval, and the Luddites took their wooden shoes off and jammed them in the machines to protest technological unemployment, the idea that they would be put out of jobs by technology. Now, you can understand this, right? If somebody feels like their livelihood is being threatened, your first reaction is going to be to lash out at the thing that you think is threatening you. But on the whole, of course, Yes, maybe some people changed jobs over time. There were not people doing the grueling work of pushing that needle back and forth all day long. I don't think anybody probably particularly enjoyed doing that. It's not a creative job. And it reduced the cost of textiles to the point where common people, I'm air quoting, common people could afford, start to afford, you know, decent clothing. Mm-hmm. And so while a small portion of people were disrupted in their careers for a short period of time, and what you typically find in these scenarios is not that massive numbers of people are losing their jobs in most cases. What happens is people start retiring as they normally would, and new people just don't enter these particular lines of work anymore.
Sure.
Another great example of this is telephone operators. It's a very interesting example in that I think everybody appreciates the internet these days. You know, it's an absolutely amazing thing that has enabled so much benefit for us. Well, you know, telephone operators sat there behind a console all day long, plugging wires in and out of a board to try and connect calls from one place to another. And when the automated switchboard first came along, there was some concern, oh, we're going to lose jobs. But I don't think anybody today is particularly upset about the loss of the switchboard job. You know, people retired from that job and new people didn't enter that profession. But the really interesting aspect of it is if we were to try and accommodate modern communications using switchboard technology, it would take yeah. many, many times the population of the entire Earth. Like, assume 10 to 100 times the number of people on Earth to handle our communication needs that we have today. So there's always two sides to every one of these questions. So is somebody going to be upset that they can't be hunched over in the field all day long in backbreaking labor, picking strawberries? No, probably not. Do we need to make sure that we are thoughtful and sensitive about giving everybody opportunities to you know, be economically stable and have an enjoyable life? Absolutely. But when we too tightly couple those two issues, we end up in kind of an unproductive stalemate.
Yeah. I've thought of an example to support what you're talking about, which is the horse-drawn carriages and the automobile. I think, you know, when the technology is very clearly offering a clear benefit for people, they're not putting up nearly as much of a fight. You know, I don't see people, you know, there were probably some, but not as many protesting that the government should bail out the horse-drawn carriage and the stagecoach industries. You know, or not stagecoach, but you know what I mean? The horse-drawn transportation modalities to defend people from the automobile. I think maybe for a lot of people, it's a missing link or a missing, they don't see enough of the benefit to outweigh the short-term loss of jobs maybe. And it's, maybe it takes time.
Yeah. A lot of it is just based around fear of the unknown. And I think that this is understandable given Hollywood's portrayal of robots. The word robot is really misleading. There is no robot. There will be no robots for the foreseeable future. What there is automation. And we have had automation, again, going all the way back to the automatic shuttle in the loom. It's no different. Technology allows human beings to be more productive. It allows us to do more in less time. It allows us to do more with less money. Ultimately, this should be a good thing for humanity across the board. We just have to, again, be sensitive to make sure we're taking care of the most vulnerable members of our society and not just leaving them out in the cold because you know, they need, you know, the job that they used to do no longer is valued at the same level it was by society in the past. Well, you know, we have a responsibility to try and help retrain, to try and provide safety nets for that. for those categories of people.
Absolutely.
We can't shun that responsibility. But the answer is not to not progress. That would ultimately harm the exact people we're trying to protect even more.
Yeah. And I think locally, you know, in terms of, you spoke a little bit about the lack of laborers, maybe to do a lot of the work that needs to be done at the, you know, all the farms in this area. The housing is worth, you know,
problem.
Mentioning. And maybe that's even part of that responsibility that maybe hasn't been held up, you know, looking after people's needs who are on the lower end, typically economically, of society.
Yeah, it's a bit of a challenge, and I want to be careful here not to get myself into too much trouble. But, you know, I think our government sometimes is not quite aligned with their own goals. You know, when I was considering buying this farm, I called a number of government agencies, San Mateo County, state, others, you know, talking to them about what I wanted to do, why I felt it was important, you know, how my goal is to help solve local and global food supply technology problems. I got all kinds of encouragement. It was all smiles and nods and yeses. Well, after I bought the property, everything changed, and I have run into nothing but red tape and challenges across the board. And I don't think it's necessarily bad intentions anywhere, but it's just we've become so focused on regulation that we can't get anything done. Right, we actually had some farm labor housing here that we had to take down because the previous owners, had not crossed every T and dotted all the I's perfectly. So, you know, we had to tear down, what many would consider perfectly good housing, and we're trying to comply with all the local ordinances and everything to get farm labor housing built. Everybody that we talk to about working here at the farm says, yes, I'd love that, but I don't have housing. Can you provide housing? And we have to say, boy, we would love to, but we can't provide housing because it's taking us years and years to work through all the bureaucracy to actually build the housing that we would need to offer you. So that would be something that I would certainly draw people's attention to. I know that people who live in the city tend to favor lots of strict rules about, things like Airbnbs and what people can build and what they can't build. You know, out here on the farm, it's a whole different world, and we're being killed by that. Access to labor is tied directly to access to housing. And if we can't have housing, we're just dead in the water.
Yeah, I definitely I see what you're talking about. And I think that's a whole other discussion. We could talk about that for a long time. And so maybe I'll have to explore creating a show around that phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. And I think if we stopped worrying about who to blame and we all just gotten engaged locally in actually doing good things to help people, I think you'd see a major turnaround across the board. We all expect the government to fix our problems and get very, very passionate about that. My vote would be each one of us get out there and get involved directly in local community service efforts, and the world would be a different place.
Think globally, but act locally. Back on target. Yeah. Here to the point of this show. I feel like we're getting a little far afield.
That's right.
But I appreciate it. I actually am very much eager to tie something as innocent as food production to pretty deep philosophical questions that, you know, that we're being confronted with all the time.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate you going there with me a little bit about all of those pieces of it. But I do want to bring it back, talking about the global situation that we're seeing ourselves in right now with the pandemic and the shutting down of the supply chain for goods and services. Are there any things that you've had a tough time finding for your farm? I mean, it sounds like you're doing a really good job of really depending on really your own energy inputs to operate.
Yeah.
But without you know, anything you're comfortable talking about? Is there anything that you're surprised by, or that you, you know, you've had to just make yourself, maybe even locally, because you haven't been able to find it through normal channels?
No, you know, I think we've been very fortunate. Because our whole philosophy was self-reliance and complete local sourcing, we just haven't really run into that situation as much. So I think we're in pretty good shape there, you know, other than the continual labor issue. You know, obviously the epidemic is in some sense going to help with that, in that, you know, there is unemployment is going up significantly. So that's not a great thing by any stretch, but, you know, maybe it will help bring more people back to agriculture type jobs. That could be interesting.
Yeah, well, certainly everybody's interested. I've been looking online, and apparently the searches for things like growing your own food, how to raise chickens has blown up. Like, everybody's trying to figure out how to start their own food and become more food resilient. It's entering the consciousness.
Yeah, that's really our mission, is to try and you know, help figure out better ways to do those things, and then to share that knowledge. Let me just go through a quick list of our cool tech projects here, if that would be of interest.
I would love that. Please do.
So we already talked about the chicken RFID tracking. One of the really fun projects we're doing is called GoatBot, which is a way of geofencing goats that allows them to roam freely in general, but we're able to guide them to the areas of the farm where we would prefer that they browse. How does this save money? Well, normally you would have to go and set up fencing every time you wanted to confine your goats to a particular area. And the fact that this is a geofence solution that can be done dynamically, it's a lot healthier for the land, because you can move them around much more regularly and dynamically, so they're doing the right amount of browsing while not doing damage. This actually allows us to provide yet another input for our chickens, because the goats will go out and they will eat things like you know, brush and thistle and poison oak, and goats are pretty amazing that they can take all of that kind of random vegetation and turn it into high quality milk. And then we use that milk. We don't sell the milk directly. We will use the milk to do things like make soap, but we actually feed all the excess milk to our chickens. Our chickens absolutely love the goat's milk. It's a great supplement to their diet. And what it does is it extends their forage range, because now chickens are essentially able to eat those other you know, types of vegetation and turn those into eggs. It's a two-step process, obviously. So the GoatBot project is pretty fun from that perspective. It's basically a collar that the goats wear. It has a wireless receiver in it and a GPS receiver. And so it's constantly wiring back to our server where each goat is located. And then through a series of different types of inputs and stimuli to the goats, basically tones, we're able to help guide the goats to where we want them to go.
Wow.
Another project, which is a lot of fun, is around the Precision Farming Rover. So the Precision Farming Rover is a project that we are building to really act as a platform for app development from a wide range of farmers and other companies. The idea is that we are solving the basic robotic problems of how do you have a robot that can move from point A to point B on a farm safely? How do you manage the energy? How do you manage the networking and the data transfer? How do you deal with all those things? Those are hard problems that we can deal with. And then we provide that platform to app developers, very similar to, you know, people who will write an app for your iPhone. The great thing about that model is, you know, some of the coolest apps that we have were made by teenagers who, you know, just had the ability to write some software. that they could have never done that if they had to build the whole cell phone from scratch, right? So this is really the model here. We provide the robot. The robot takes care of all of the hard stuff. And then they are able to write applications that solve local farming needs that we wouldn't even know about. A big focus of that project is to build it to be very, very low cost, very lightweight, and something that a small farmer, perhaps even in Africa, could afford and then maintain and repair him or herself.
Wow, that's amazing.
So it's an exciting project. It's in work still. We're not yet selling them, but we've solved most of the hard problems on that now. Another really cool project we're working on is around hydroponics. So hydroponics is soilless growing. There are a lot of benefits to soilless growing. One of the biggest is the water conservation. So traditional in-soil agriculture uses about 10 times the water that a hydroponic system does. And obviously, access to fresh water is a ongoing challenge, particularly here in California. So the problem with hydroponics is it can be incredibly expensive to set up. Once you have the system all set up, it can be very cost effective, and it can produce high quality organic food at a relatively low cost, because you don't have a lot of the problems of in-soil farming in terms of fungus and pests and heavy water usage and those type of things. So our project there is a USDA funded grant around how do we make the setup of a hydroponic system much more cost effective, much lower upfront costs. And the way we're doing that is by using a lot of the warehouse automation technology that another company of mine has developed. That company is called Vecna Robotics. Vecna Robotics is a world leader in automated bulk handling. Think of automated forklifts, a driverless forklift. So the idea here is, can we use that type of technology to automate hydroponic systems to reduce a lot of the upfront costs in terms of all the infrastructure that's needed? You need big conveyor systems and a lot of built-in infrastructure for the way hydroponics is done today. Our approach is to use essentially a pallet-based system so that you can essentially start with an empty lot, an empty warehouse, an empty field, and essentially have a hydroponic system up and running in a matter of weeks to days rather than months to years.
Wow, that's amazing. And it sounds like, from what I know of hydroponics, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a way to actually bring local produce even closer to, cities and other densely populated areas, is it not?
Yeah, that's right. Now, there are some, there are some misconceptions around hydroponics that I think would be good for me to address. Over the past decade, we've seen a number of times when people get this idea of indoor, growing crops indoors with artificial lighting. We can use LED lights, and LEDs are more efficient, and so everything would be great. Bad idea. Let me just caution people. And the reason for that is, even with LEDs, the cost of producing the electricity needed to produce sufficient photosynthesis in the plants is cost prohibitive. The only place it actually works, to have 100% artificial light grown produce is in Japan. And the reason it works in Japan is because the cost of produce there is already off the charts, and the cost of land is, for similar reasons, very, very high. So there they have found that it is economically feasible to basically take a warehouse and do what we call vertical farming, where they just have racks and racks of plants, each under lights. It takes massive amounts of electricity. That electricity obviously is produced somewhere, which is generally releasing a lot of carbon into the atmosphere. So is it a sustainable practice? No. The carbon cost is high. But if you can do hydroponics and take advantage of the sun. You know, the sun is the most economical and ecologically friendly power source we have, obviously, then it makes a lot of sense. So the idea with hydroponics is that you can do it on, ideally you can do it on a small scale, much closer to the, you know, the point of consumption. And, you know, I think if people are interested in exploring that particular model more, I'd love to have them be beta testers of the system we're putting together.
Well, great. I think that we should encourage people to reach out to you. How should they best do that?
I think if they go to our webpage at twistedfields.com, there's a place to contact us. That would probably be the most effective.
Excellent. Would it be safe to assume that you've had a previous life in technology or engineering in some capacity?
Yeah, that's true. I grew up in San Jose. I was very fortunate to have access to technology. You know, my children have had trouble getting access to even basic programming classes in public schools. I'm a big fan of the public school system. You know, we need to make sure that our children have access to good technology education. And Independence High School, then I was fortunate enough to be selected as the top computer science student in all of California and got to spend a summer at Lawrence Livermore National Lab programming the Cray computer there, which at the time was the fastest supercomputer in the world.
Wow.
And from there, I went on to MIT and have been focusing on automation and robotics to try and make the world a better place and solve some of the most challenging problems facing humanity.
Well, did your move to this area coincide with your transition to the world of farming?
Yeah, I've always had a passion for growing things and have always wanted to have a farm. It turns out that I was doing a research project with the USDA, and I was living in Massachusetts at the time. And I was out in the area meeting with some of my collaborators at UC Davis. And I thought, you know, someday I'd love to have a farm. I'd love to come back to the Bay Area where I grew up. Let me just look at some real estate while I'm out here. Fortunately, this property had sufficient water rights to be able to farm effectively.
Great. Do you have relationships with your neighbors, or in fact, do you have relationships with other farmers that you rely on for operating your business or buying any of your own food products?
Yeah, we're building those relationships more and more. It's been fun to come into contact over time with like-minded farmers who realize that we have a responsibility to figure these things out. You know, as a bumper sticker I saw a while ago so aptly pointed out, no farms, no food. And, you know, if we completely lose the idea of a local farm and become completely dependent on large industrial farming, we're going to find ourselves in a pickle as a species. So there are a lot of farmers out here that realize that and are motivated to try and help us solve some of these problems facing humanity. I'd say that a lot of people are friendly and well aligned with that mission. You know, I think sometimes people can be set in their ways and not realize that there's more than one way to do things. And that's certainly one of the challenges that we've run into, is that, you know, oftentimes people will just say, no, this is the way you do it. This is the way it's always been done. This is the right way to do it. You know, that can be a real impediment to progress. We have to be willing to make mistakes if we're going to learn. I like to tell people that enlightened trial and error will always produce the best results. But if you're afraid to make a mistake, then we never have that serendipity of discovering an elegant solution that no one's ever going to come up with just, you know, out of thin air.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like quite possibly this country and many other countries may have made the mistake of globalizing our own food chain. As much as globalization has improved, you know, the human condition so much, like you talk about with, you know, the contributions of technology and like so many things that we buy, especially technology, you know, like a Boeing airplane is actually manufactured in like, you know, 30 or 40 countries by thousands of companies from all over the world. Can you talk about how maybe the globalization, we need to rethink that through the lens of, you know, local, buying local and selling local?
We will always, as a species, go through cycles of learning. And I'm a believer that technology will help us to be better. And one of the ways that will happen is because as technology has democratized so many things. So, you know, the idea that we can use technology to effectively do things now that used to take a factory to do in the past is really encouraging. The thing about technology is technology gets focused on the things that we value. And what we value is, I think, the thing we need to examine most. I think, unfortunately, we tend to value you know, convenience, entertainment, comfort, oftentimes a lot more than some other things that will perhaps, you know, provide more value in the long term.
Like food.
Exactly, like food, right? And we did not understand the cost of junk food on our society just a couple of short decades ago. We just didn't understand the massive cost of bad food, but it is overwhelming our healthcare system. So I think that that's a problem that we can solve, and I think technology empowering the small local farmer, technology empowering the consumer by helping connect them with the small local farmer in new ways is something that ultimately will solve these problems. You know, I think we will continue to see a number of crops produced on mega scale, you know, wheat and those type of things. You know, probably not a lot of real incentive for anyone to grow those things locally. But there's a wide range of other crops that technology can allow us to grow locally. I believe that in the future, you know, 20 plus years from now, you will see the majority of food grown locally through a number of approaches using technology like controlled environment agriculture. And you'll start to see a significant positive impact on the health and well-being of our society as a whole.
Well, I hope you're right. You know, access to healthy organic food is a, you know, should be a human right. And if technology can lower the cost of it to make those local products available for more people, I think it's going to, you know, benefit this country, but everybody in the world in the long run.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for joining me. This has been really interesting. How should our listeners, where should they go to find out more about Twisted Fields?
Twistedfields.com. There's a Twisted Fields Instagram account at Twisted Fields. You probably could have guessed that. We are anxious and open to collaborating with anybody that's interested in helping to solve this problem. If you'd like to sign up for our CSA program, either for eggs or our farm share program, we would encourage you to do that. And that will help not only support the farm and its research, but you'll benefit from healthier, more enjoyable food as well.
Well, great. Thanks for sharing that, Daniel. I really appreciate your time. This has been really interesting. I love the angle that you're coming from, and thank you for the lesson on the impact of technology on civilization.
Happy to talk more anytime.
This is 89.3 FM KPDO, and this is Local Revolution. I'm Aaron Murphy, and thanks for joining us. I look forward to seeing you next time on Local Revolution.